This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. My guest is Ben Affleck. Earlier this month, he won the Best Actor Award at the Venice Film Festival for his starring role in the new movie Hollywoodland. He plays George Reeves, the actor who starred in the 1950s TV series Superman. As portrayed in the film, Reeves wanted fame, but he wanted it through movies, not through playing a superhero in a TV series for kids. We're going to talk about playing the man who played Superman. Then we'll talk with Affleck about his life and some of his other roles. His other movies include Chasing Amy, Dogma, Shakespeare in Love, Pearl Harbor, Armageddon, and Good Will Hunting, which he co-wrote with Matt Damon. Let's start with a scene from Hollywoodland, just after Reeves has gotten a call from his agent. Reeves is describing the call to the woman he's having an affair with, who's the wife of an MGM executive. She's played by Diane Lane.
Got a call. They're picking up Superman.
They're what?
Kellogg's.
Bought it.
After 2 years?
That's right. I will be on television in a month, wearing brown and gray underpants.
Well, hooray!
Christ.
Well, maybe it wasn't your proudest moment.
No. I'm quite sure it wasn't.
But you did create a very likable, very attractive, very heroic character.
Is that right?
I'd give it a second.
Well, one thing we can be sure of. No one with a lick of sense would watch that show.
Ben Affleck, welcome to Fresh Air. When you got the part of George Reeves and you went back and watched again old episodes of Superman, what things about his acting did you notice that you'd never noticed before? Things that you wanted to do, too, when you were portraying him?
Well, there are a number of things. You know, chief among them was that he had a real sort of, a real charm. And it was a kind of a kindness to him and a kind of sweetness that I think is what kids responded to. And I don't think it's something that you can really fake, that he seemed to have a really good heart and that he enjoyed this idea and played with this kind of fundamental, central, underlying element of the show that made it, I think, really good at what it was that like, he was sharing this experience with kids, that he was sharing his secret with them and kind of, I mean, sometimes quite literally winking at the audience.
One of the things I think you capture about him as Superman is the way he'd kind of almost plant his feet on the floor, shoulders back, and almost like military style posture, and then put his like hands on his hips.
There was no, one of the nice things about the period is that there wasn't a lot of pretense, you know. Nowadays, we have a kind of, our heroes have to also be sort of slouching and conflicted.
Exactly.
And have the weight of the world on their
head.
And
right.
This, there was no pretense to that. It was like he was Superman. He was proud and strong, and he had his hands on his hips, and he looked out into the middle distance because he was strong and he was going to protect people. It wasn't, you know, this whole idea of like the hero now in movies and stories is, you know, doesn't want to have the curse of these powers, you know, and
yeah.
He had no such qualms. And even the kind of acting and the behavior style of the 1950s, if you kind of read further into it, there was kind of a presentationalism that was present in acting, which was a kind of self-conscious way of saying, I know I'm about to sit on this couch and smile at this woman, and I'm going to do so in a way that I hope is kind of endearing, you know, like Spencer Tracy, for example, did that really well, or Clark Gable. And I think that was present in social interactions too. You know, men wore hats and had kerchiefs in their pockets, and even if you didn't have any money, real working people tried to wear suits. It was an era of kind of trying to, you know, put on airs. wasn't a bad thing. It wasn't a put down. You know,
and there was even a more formal style of speaking in movies, no matter how informal the characters were supposed to be. And all of this is not your generation's style of acting. So do you feel like you had to change your style of acting and not be conflicted and be more presentational?
Well, playing him in a way, I mean, obviously people still felt the same thing. So one of the things I thought was really interesting about this character was he was a guy who had the same conflicted feelings. In fact, I think George had a tremendous amount of sadness, maybe depression. Definitely he was an alcoholic, probably addicted to pain pills by the end of his life. And he was a very ambitious guy who suffered from the kind of thwarted ambition and the continuing humiliation that offered. So here's a tremendous amount of pain and difficulty, and yet he's living in a world that really where you have to kind of stiff upper lip and, you know, be gracious and still kind of be charming, because anything less than that is to admit a kind of unimaginable and terrible defeat. So I thought there was something really dramatically interesting. And on the one hand, having a guy who's full of agony and pain, but on the other hand, has to put on a good face.
But when you're playing him as an actor on the set acting,
right,
you have to go into a different, into a different acting style.
Absolutely. And one of the things I did to research that was really interesting is, rather than just watching him, I watched all his movies, I listened to all his stuff, I watched home videos, I talked to people who knew him. I went through the kind of, you know, the regular steps that you would take, obviously, researching somebody. But additionally, I thought, you know, here was a guy who was ambitious and kind of wanted to be other people, right? There's a line where he says he'd like to have Clark Gable's career. He is influenced in a way, not as much by who he actually is, but by who he wants to be. So I watched a lot of these movies at the time to see what were the things that he would be emulating. What were the styles that he would be trying to affect in his own performance? And so in effect, I tried to emulate those as he would have. And in doing, I think, ended up with that same kind of style, which, you know, was popular in the 50s, which was to speak really fast. You know, movies would be a lot shorter now if they had that 50s kind of clip of like, "Say, fella, what do you know? Nothing, chum. I don't know. Hey, back from the war? I sure am. Smoke camels. They're milder." It was like just, you know, very kind of repetitive, kind of zipping through your lines. And, you know, picking up on that and playing with that was really fun for me, because it was so completely counter to the sort of ultra tape recorder realism, naturalistic style of our time.
What did it feel like to actually put on the famous tights and the famous cape?
It was daunting to a certain extent. We were really concerned with realism in the sense that we wanted it to be really consistent with how they did it, particularly in that show, particularly when we're filming, you know, scenes that had to do with either him as Clark Kent or him as Superman, because everybody, you know, who watched the show obviously would have a pretty strong sense of what looked real and what didn't look real, what was, you know, jived with their memory and their sense of how it was, you know, done. And so one of the things I was able to do, there's a television kind of archive memorabilia people here, so have a museum, and I'm forgetting their name, which is a shame because I really appreciated what they did. But anyway, he came by, brought the actual suit that George wore and the rubber foam, you know, muscle suit underneath, and let me not only wear it, you know, not only touch it, but, you know, put it over my head and look at it. And that was a really kind of surreal moment where I was like sort of reaching out and touching the actual clothes that he wore, and you could see all these sweat stains and the thing, and you understood why it was so oppressive. He complained bitterly about it. And as he got more control, interestingly, later on in the series, there was much less of Superman and much more of Clark Kent. He would get these rashes and he would sweat, and, you know, he drank all day while he was doing the show because he was so miserable. And so then he would start to sweat the alcohol, which would like break down the foam rubber, and it was just a disaster. And the outside of the suit, you had this rubber that didn't breathe, and then the you know, tights, as it were, was basically just a wool sweater that was knitted, you know, with the S on it and everything else. And, you know, that combined with the fact that the film was so incredibly slow back then, it needed so much light to be dumped on to in order to be able to see, that, you know, they had these giant, incredibly hot lights. And also they hadn't figured out the technology of keeping lights cooler. So he literally roasted in this outfit. And I wanted to get a kind of a sense of that, because everything I read about him, they talked about how incredibly oppressive this outfit was. And I thought that was kind of nicely, and, you know, if not too obviously, representative of how onerous he found, you know, playing Superman, and the whole experience was kind of a burden on him.
The film isn't a comedy, but one of the funny lines in the movie is after he puts on his suit for a promotional appearance, he says, and before he walks out and meets his audience of children in this promotional appearance, he says to somebody after putting on the costume, "Is my penis showing?" And I thought, this is exactly the kind of thing that everybody always wondered if he thought about, you know? So is there any evidence he actually said that and wondered about it?
He was a very lively guy, and there's a lot of evidence that he thought about and joked about that kind of thing a fair bit. You know, a lot of times we look back at people in the 50s, and because their work is so, you know, had to fit into the constraints of the censors, and, you know, it was all kind of pretty chaste, that their actual personality somehow might have reflected that, which really isn't the case, I don't think. You know, and he was very, I don't know, ribald or whatever. He, you know, he'd make a lot of jokes about his penis and what could or couldn't be seen, and his, you know, taking his trousers off. And there's a scene in the movie where we do a bit where he actually kind of, what he would do quite regularly, which is kind of like break up on the set by pretending to, you know, like something with Lois where he says, do you want to see the real Man of Steel? And he takes his pants off and he's sort of like pawing at her. And then, you know, Jimmy says, you know, says great, the chief comes in and says, great Caesar's ghost. And, you know, he says, more powerful than a locomotive. You know, he was the sexual innuendo and jokes like that, I think, did a lot to, and talking about how obviously foolishly revealing the outfit was, did a lot to kind of mitigate that embarrassment of feeling like a grown adult working on a television show. And as a way, kind of reminding themselves that they were adults, you know, and trying to hold on to their dignity in some way, ironically.
You know, in George Reeves' case, he was typecast in that Superman role and couldn't break out of it. And, you know, a lot of people have drawn parallels to, like, your life in the sense, not that you were held hostage by a role, but by your private life for a period of time because of the whole Jennifer Lopez thing, the whole Bennifer thing. So are there ways in which that you identified with Reeves?
There are a number of ways in which I identify with Reeves. I guess there is a sense, kind of what you're alluding to, is there is a typecasting that happened then, which is about, you know, I can't watch George Reeves in this movie and take him seriously as Captain Stark because I just think of him as Superman. And I can't get that out of my head, and that's all I'm reminded of. So I have no ability to suspend disbelief and follow along with the story. I think there's the modern equivalent of that is similar but not the same, which is you can get typecast as yourself. In other words, audiences become so familiar with, particularly because of the proliferation of all these entertainment kind of media outlets, which is basically, you know, gussied up tabloids, whether in print or in electronic media, that, you know, because there's so many of them and there's this bigger audience, there's a bigger market, they run out of material, so they have to kind of create material, and then they really, you know, they overdo the sort of inane, like the truly pedestrian, to the point where, you know, you really know what, you know, some actor, maybe an actor you don't even like, or whose movies you haven't even seen, how, what they look like taking out the trash, and what their marital status is, and where their kids go to school, and what they look like in the morning before they've put their makeup on, or whatever it is. You get inundated with these images, whether you want to or not, almost, you know, on your AOL homepage, and every time you walk by a newsstand, and every time you turn on a television, you know, that it becomes hard to think of the person as a spaceman or as a, you know, as D.H. Lawrence or something. You just think that's not D.H. Lawrence. So that's the problem with that kind of typecasting. And I think because I was in a kind of high-profile relationship right around the time when media companies discovered that there was a bigger market for this entertainment pop culture stuff than they thought. And so everybody knew, as you say, that's this like a nickname for a relationship or, you know, details about a relationship that seem, it's just kind of, you can't believe other people know those sort of things about somebody else. It's like stuff I don't know about, you know, good friends of mine.
Yeah, well, the idea of being typecast as yourself so that people can't believe you playing a role is really interesting, and that certainly rings true. You know, in playing George Reeves in Hollywoodland, he's actually having an affair through the movie with the wife of an MGM studio executive. And the press basically doesn't cover that. And there's another studio executive whose job it is to make sure that stories like that don't get covered, you know, that the stars are protected. So did you think a lot about the difference between press coverage of movie stars then and now?
Yeah, I yearned for those days. I couldn't. I thought, how wonderful would it be? How much better would my life have been? Career, everything, psychological well-being, if there was some, you know, velvet hammer enforcer guy who every time the press wanted to write something about, you know, ugly about someone's personal life, they just went around and broke their ankles. The idea is just so appealing.
Then your new movie, Hollywoodland, I think it's a really terrific film. I really enjoyed it.
Nice.
Before that, you were in a series of movies that didn't do so well. Recent films like Geely and Jersey Girl, Daredevil didn't do that well. Did you think
Daredevil did pretty well?
Did it do
actually,
well? Good. Sorry. Thank you for correcting
me. It's
okay.
I mean, it depends what you want to, you know, it depends how you define it. Again, it made $100 million. Is it my favorite
movie? Well, that
movie?
Sounds good. Sounds good. Yeah. But is it hard to judge from a screenplay how good something's going to be?
Well, you raise an interesting point. It's kind of twofold. One is it depends on what your basis for evaluation is. You know what I mean? Like Pearl Harbor is a good example. Made a fortune. And a lot of people, it was like kind of pretty thoroughly pilloried. So it depends what's your goal there. Obviously, your goal is to make a good movie and ostensibly, you know, a return on the people who've invested their money in your movie. Because if they don't see that, you're not likely to continue to have people invest in you or your movies. So you have to serve two masters in that sense to a certain extent. Although, increasingly, I've come to believe that one kind of drives the other, quality drives the other, but not completely. I mean, it would be naive to say that. I think, you know, I like Jersey Girl. Geely was a movie that had nobler intentions and that got totally derailed and exploded by me being in a relationship with Jennifer Lopez. It didn't help that the movie didn't work. You know, and it's really hard. You don't really know. You know, it's a good example. I mean, Marty Brest directed one of my favorite movies in Midnight Run, and it was a really good script, and a lot of people wanted to be in that movie, and it was a coup for me to get the part. You know, it was a big deal. And then, you know, a movie doesn't end up working. You never know. It's a gamble.
Now, you know, you're playing somebody who played a superhero in the new movie Hollywoodland. And you played a superhero yourself, of course, in Daredevil. Did you grow up with a lot of, like, comic books? Because, like, there's Daredevil, which is based on a comic figure, of course, Superman. And in the movie Chasing Amy, you played a comic book artist. Does that have, like, personal connections for you?
Yeah, the reason that I did Daredevil, really, was because that was my favorite kind of comic book character growing up. And, you know, that was a sort of mixed experience doing that movie. And ultimately, in some ways, that movie and doing it was sort of about how losing your... Another way of saying, like, okay, I had these sort of feelings about this character as a child, and now seeing how I see it differently as an adult... One of the things it definitely did for me was give me an appreciation for George Reeves' dread of and feelings of absurdity about, you know, putting on a really cumbersome child's costume and pretending to go around and fight crime. You know, for one thing, you're acutely aware of the fact every time you put it on that it's kind of difficult just to walk across the room, much less go out there and corral bad guys. Additionally, it can kind of feel really humiliating. You know, you have it like half on, or you're just wearing the mask and you're, you know, your shorts or whatever because it's so hot. And it just feels like, God, is this what I spent time, you know, like dreaming about as a kid and training for and trying to be an actor? So it was, you know, that wasn't the whole way I felt about Daredevil, obviously, but there were moments where I had those feelings, and that movie, if nothing else, was very good preparation for this movie.
Why did you start dreaming about acting as a kid?
Well, you know, I was that's a hard thing to say. I was a child actor. I've definitely been, it's always something I felt like I had, I liked doing. I kind of guess I felt like I got some sense of self-esteem from it. I thought I was, you know, I would do sort of imitations or jokes even as a kid. I guess it's basically kind of, you know, precociousness, you know, in childhood. And then I sort of cultivated that, and, you know, I could kind of do voices and stuff. And then I would got into, at a young age, got sort of, because of whatever my personality or for some reason, I was asked to audition for something as a kid. I got that part. It was a PBS television series for children called Voyage of the Mimi. So then I did that from when I was about 9, you know, intermittently, from when I was 9 to about 13. And so then I started getting all this experience acting, and it was something that I felt I really liked doing, and I really felt like I was kind of good at. And I didn't feel like I was good at a lot else. So I got some, like I said, some self-esteem from it. And then I just started educating myself about all these actors out there and who they are and what their kind of art that they had to offer to the world was. And I just thought, like, this is who I want to be. I want to be somebody who can do this, and I want to learn how to do it better, and I want to kind of give myself over to that. So I've been trying to do that ever since.
What did you do as a child and young teenager to try to learn to act better?
You know, I had a really great, and this is probably something you hear a lot, but I had a really great drama teacher, a guy named Jerry Specka in high school. And, you know, this is from when I was 14. And he kind of taught that acting in some ways in theater and art were all looked at as part of life, not as a separate kind of a thing. And that lessons could be drawn from one into the other, and that you could look at them kind of all as part of the same whole. And by the same token, he also taught that kind of writing and acting were sort of part of indirecting, were all part of the same discipline, which is kind of what empowered Matt Damon and I, who also had this, Matt also had this teacher, to go ahead and kind of have the courage to write our own movie to act in, and that that wasn't, you know, you didn't have to be, it didn't require some other additional, I don't know what, you know, credentials to do that, that we could have the courage to kind of do that and kind of improvise it. And it was very empowering for us.
You mentioned, you know, working with Matt Damon, writing Good Will Hunting. When you wrote the film, I mean, he's the one who got the bigger part. Did you feel like you should have had an equally big part? Did that bother you?
I should have had a bigger part. No, well, part of it was very, you know, what we did with that movie was we were kind of, because all these independent movies have started to come out, like Do the Right Thing and Slacker and Dazed and Confused and, you know, Clerks, Reservoir Dogs. There was this growing awareness that kind of, if you wanted to break in, you could kind of do it yourself and you could do it on the cheap, but you needed a few components. We knew that, you know, Quentin Tarantino somehow got Reservoir Dogs to Harvey Keitel. And because Harvey Keitel did it, you know, he was able to make his movie. And so when we wrote it, on one hand, we had this kind of creative side to what we wanted to do, which was we wanted to tell this story. And then in terms of storytelling, it was equally influenced by the pragmatic kind of how do we get our movie made side, where we knew, okay, you got to have a girl. We need to have a part, a kind of very winning hero part for an actor that was, say, 50, because that was kind of the age that most of those like, you know, your whoever it was, your De Niro's, your Pacino's, your, you know, obviously Robin was the top of our list, but your Robin Williams, those type of guys. So we said, okay, we need to have a part that will be appealing to one of those guys because they'll get to be great in the movie because we can't pay them any money. And we have to make it small enough that it doesn't take up much of their time. And all the scenes that they're in have to be about them. And then we have to have a girl and we have to have a lead. And then, you know, I was sort of like, I got to be the kind of Mercutio character, was sort of how we modeled it. Now, because you can't really have two leads in a movie in a way. And Matt, also, we needed, the idea was that someone had to let us do the movie. That, you know, people looked at us kind of like we were crazy. And I had historically had a few kind of supporting parts in movies. And then Matt had had two leading parts in movies, in School Ties and in Geronimo, the Walter Hill Western with Jason Patrick. So we felt like it would just be more palatable to people that, you know, we could get that past them. And then I would get to play a slightly more outrageous and ostensibly somewhat more kind of charactery and interesting part in playing the role of Chucky.
Well, you know, having co-written Good Will Hunting, is there anything from that movie that comes really directly from your life?
You know, there are a lot of different things. It's hard to say. You spent so much time with somebody. It's a lot of stuff from my life, Matt's life. My father was a janitor at Harvard University. It wasn't MIT, but it was sort of similar. We definitely had a kind of town and gown relationship with Harvard kids. We grew up in Central Square in Cambridge, which was the sort of, at the time, it was the across-the-track side of Cambridge. I don't think there is an across-the-track side anymore. But, you know, so we had that kind of relationship that was, you know, we saw these kind of privileged, educated kids who, you know, came into the city and were somehow, you know, assumed to be either better than us or smarter than us and had that kind of resentment and something to prove. And so that bar scene where, you know, Will confronts that sort of pompous, preppy kid from Harvard and does so by sort of an intellectual duel, you know, winning the duel, was kind of a fantasy wish fulfillment thing for us as, like, you know, kids from that city. You know, and then there's a lot of, you know, smaller details. The Sean character, the Robin Williams character, is in a lot of ways based on, you know, our drama teacher that we talked about in terms of as a mentor, kind of father figure. And there were a lot of stuff that was, you know, was a little bit more too personal to kind of get into. But I don't think you can do anything that you really care about with having, without having some of your, you know, personal life and history bleed into it.
You have a movie that you directed that's coming out in 2007, I mm-hmm. think.
It'll be out about a my hope is either a year from either now or it'll be out next spring, one or the other.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. So, and is it based on a Dennis Lehane novel?
Yes, it's based on a Dennis Lehane novel called Gone Baby Gone, which was his first novel. His first five books were a series of detective books with these two detectives, Angie Gennaro and Patrick Kenzie, who sort of went who in Boston and you know went through and kind of handled these various cases and such. And this is actually the fourth book in that series, and it's kind of a sort of crime morality drama, sort of morally ambiguous story about children in a really scary, unpleasant world. And and it's, you know, I got a great cast, and we just finished shooting in Boston, which was terrific. And I'll be editing and trying to put the movie together, you know, for the next 6 months or so.
Your brother Casey Affleck's in your film. What was it like to direct your brother?
It was really interesting. You know, it was kind of it's hard because you have to put on a different hat. You know what I mean? You can't have this conversation with your brother the way you'd have it with your brother if he's an actor in your movie. You have to treat him as you would treat an actor in the movie, which sometimes means, I mean, something as simple as trying to swallow the urge to strangle him, you know, or to be really curt with, like, just because I said to do it that way, that's why, you know, instead of going like, well, okay, that's interesting. I hear you. Let's process what you're talking about. So it was an exercise in self-discipline. But, you know, my brother, the thing that's really rewarding is that he's a really, really good actor, and he's typically been seen in, you know, kind of character roles as well. So I think, you know, I have the good fortune of being able to show an audience something kind of new and surprising that's also really good. And that's a rarity.
It's lucky you had faith in him and didn't have to make up an excuse about why you were not going to cast him in your movie.
Exactly. You're just not that right for it. I don't know. No, I'm casting another 30-year-old Caucasian 5'10 man. But he has brown eyes.
Thanks so much for talking with us.
Thank you very much.
Ben Affleck is starring in the new movie Hollywoodland. Earlier this month at the Venice Film Festival, he won the Best Actor Award for his performance in the film.